Someone just asked me whether this Bible study on Esther will continue into next week, and it won't. This is one day that we will look at one particular book, one particular person, and yet it's a continuation of the themes that we have been looking at in the Bible study, I think also in our many of our sessions this week, the theme of exile, and how is it that God's people respond in faith amidst exile. The book of Esther is not one that is very familiar to many of us, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One of the reasons is that the Bible studies that we use, particularly in the Lutheran Church in North America, and also the lectionaries that determine the readings for our Gospel and Old Testament and Epistle lessons on Sunday, do not include many of the stories of women in the Bible. They are simply left out. And so we have to go back to the scriptures themselves to find those. And the story of Esther is one where there is, which is a story of a woman of faith who acts courageously amidst a time of social and political crisis. There is another, though very good, reason that we don't know much about Esther, and that is that Martin Luther hated this book. He thought, and others as well have said, that he would have been just as glad if on that day when people sat around the table and decided which books would be in the Bible and which books would not be, that Esther had been left out. Thank you very much. The book of Esther is an extremely important book for the Jewish people. And even in this day and age, every year the Festival of Purim is celebrated for 2 days of every year, when the Jewish people stop and remember how God acts amidst exile to deliver the people. And it is on the book of Esther that the Jewish festival of Purim is based. I think I would classify this book as historical fiction. There's not a lot of evidence that what is described in this book actually happened. And yet there is clearly evidence that many of the reference of the book were historical realities. Much as when Jesus would tell a parable, people didn't necessarily know the individual of which he was speaking. For instance, the parable of the sower and the seed. He wasn't talking about a particular sower, but of the action of sowing, which was an experience that most of his hearers would know. In the same way, the book of Esther has pulled up from history various circumstances and woven them together in a story to tell how God acts amidst the crisis of exile to deliver God's people. I've entitled it "For Such a Time as This." And before we look at the story itself, I want to take a moment together with you to describe the time in which we are. And we've been doing a lot of that this week. And I want each of you to think of your city or your county. City if you're an urban person, county if you're a rural person. What are the two most pressing issues that face you at this time? I don't want an exhaustive list, but I want the two most pressing issues that face your city or your county at this time. And I'm talking about social, political issues that threaten or that address who we are as people, not as Christian people in the broadest sense, but who we are as a society. Pardon me? Can you say it louder, please?
Taxes and expansion.
Taxes and expansion. What do you mean by expansion?
Growth.
Growth.
Building.
Okay, I'm writing those down here. And just call them out.
New elementary school.
Right.
Question.
Okay. Well, what do you mean by new elementary school?
Whether we need one and trying to pass that bond agreement.
More schools.
Affordable housing.
Okay, housing?
In Seattle, the whole school busing issue.
Busing, particularly in reference to schools?
Land use.
Land use?
Abortion.
Racism?
Prison overcrowding.
Abortion?
Alcoholism and drug abuse.
Prisons? Alcohol and drug abuse?
Garbage disposal.
Garbage disposal. Is that the garbologist?
I swear.
Okay, where do you live?
Seattle.
Seattle.
Garbage disposal?
That's key kids.
Okay, latchkey kids, so family.
Education cutbacks.
Jobs, unemployment.
Education cutbacks, unemployment. Okay.
Hungry people.
Farm crisis. Okay, I write until I run out of room, and then I stop.
Unless someone has a real pressing one that you need to add.
Crime?
Crime.
Okay, I want you to push your vision out a bit. Think of your nation. If it's the United States, if it's Canada, if it's another nation, think of your nation. What are the two critical issues that are confronting your nation at this time?
Debt.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, debt.
I guess,
including foreign policy.
Foreign policy?
Politicians.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
That means that you can't control them.
Okay, are you referring to the
too
trust?
Too much power.
Okay, misuse of power, is that what you're getting at?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Terrorism.
Terrorism.
AIDS.
Contras. That would be foreign policy again.
Health.
So,
nuclear arms race.
Health. Nuclear arms.
Abortion.
Credibility.
Okay, credibility. Internally or?
Internally.
Okay, credibility.
Peace.
Poverty.
Poverty. Peace. I have to add one from Canada, unemployment.
Postal strike.
Peace, postal strike. Is that a Canadian one? Yeah, thanks, because that's one for us. Unemployment is, and hunger for Canada.
Quebec.
Quebec. Okay, one more. Push your sights out yet again. Global community. What are the two most pressing issues which face us as a global community? And it's okay if you're repeating yourself. As a matter of fact, when you go home, when you're in your congregation, if you're asking that question that we asked the other night, how do we get started in our congregation? This is one of the ways you do it. Gather a group of people and go through this exercise and choose one issue and take it in its local, its national, and its global manifestation and work on only one. That's a way to get going. If you're wanting to get involved in social ministry in a congregation, but that's on the side.
Individual rights.
Again?
Individual rights.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
The rights of an individual, no matter what country you live in.
Okay.
Human rights.
Human rights? Human individual rights.
Hunger.
Arms rights.
Economic instability now.
Okay, hunger, arms race,
capitalism, communism.
Okay, capitalism, communism, ideologies. Okay, lack of clean water, is that are you talking about pollution there?
Sanitation.
Yeah, just lack of clean drinking water.
Okay, drinking water.
It's supposed to be the decade of getting drinking water to everyone.
And sanitation. Okay, remember we want the top two. Okay. Any more?
Disease control, AIDS.
Okay, disease control like AIDS.
Of a threat of communism.
Okay, threat of communism and that whole capitalism, communism debate. This, before we look at Esther. And what I'd like to have you do, invite you to do, is have these signs of the times hover in your consciousness as we look at the book of Esther. Okay, to find Esther, you go to Psalms, go back through Job, back one more, and you're at Esther. And Esther is wonderful because it's a story. I teach confirmation. Confirmation's hard to teach. And what I enjoy, and I think the kids enjoy best, is when we tell the story. And so that's what I'd like to do with you today, share the story of Esther. And it begins just, you know, when you sit at night with a little child on your knee, and once upon a time, it begins that way in the days of, yes.
Can I get a clarification? You said that you thought that Esther was a fiction?
I said historical fiction.
Historical fiction. So you're saying that do you think it's a story as opposed to the truth?
Okay. I'm not an Old Testament scholar, but from the reading that I've done, and one of the reasons that there is some controversy about whether or not it should be included in the canonical scriptures is that exact question, because it really is a literary telling of a truth of the faith. In a way in which we would talk about Genesis as well. That the truth of the faith that is being told in the midst of the story is that God works in the midst of exile to bring deliverance. And that people of faith have an important role to play in God's action in history.
But you're not sure whether these events actually happened?
Well, what I'm... Yes, I'm doing more than that. What I'm saying is that some of the individuals in the story are based upon real-life characters. In other words, we're talking about a king, Ahasuerus, that is probably based upon King Xerxes. In the court of this king, there was a man named Mordecai. But whether or not the Mordecai that it's able to... in King Xerxes' court, it is possible to historically identify that there was a person there named Mordecai. Is King Ahasuerus Xerxes, and is Mordecai the Jew? Okay, I see what you're saying. For me, that's not a problem. That the person of...
For some of these other people, it might be though, and you're saying this is, I'm a learned person. And this is
no, I'm not saying I'm a learned person. I'm saying that somebody came to me 2 days ago and said, will you do the Bible study on Friday?
Silent turn. I bet if you got opinions, you'd find a lot of diversity from what you're saying. And I think, you know, it's so healthy.
Okay.
This
sure.
is also just my personal feeling. I can find so much truth in something that's not, you know, historically. I think it's like even a deeper truth. And it doesn't really matter to me whether... You know, it's exactly the way it was in history.
Okay. One, what I'm worried about is that the question you're asking is an important one, and it's an important one for a lot of people. And the question has to do with the truth that is in the stories that are for us in the Bible. And we could easily spend a whole hour on that. And if you would like to do that as a group, we could do that.
But if we get into it, we won't be able to do Esther. So that's where I'm hung up here.
No, okay.
Let's go on.
I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the fact that, oh, this is a nice story, and we think some of these people might have existed, but that's...
Okay, I guess I don't feel, oh, this is a nice story. I think this is a tremendously profound story, and it has deeply affected the Jewish people, and it has deeply affected me.
I think one of the things that leads to the inference that this is a story is that historians cannot connect these events with any recorded incidents in ancient Eastern history, mm-hmm. which raises the obvious question, well then perhaps this is story, not history. Or
any less important because
no,
it is.
Right. Or any less true.
Or any less true.
God works through all kinds of
forms. Yeah, but clearly literary devices are used within the story to raise up certain points. Okay, shall we go? Once upon a time. In the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and servants, the army chiefs of Persia and Media, and the nobles and governors of the provinces being before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his majesty for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the capital, both great and small, a banquet lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and blue hangings caught up with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and marble pillars and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden goblets, goblets of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to the law. No one was compelled. For the king had given orders to all the officials of his palace to do as every man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. Okay, so we have the setting. What do we know so far? Pardon?
They're rich.
Okay.
Lots of money to throw away.
We have a king with lots of money to throw away. A king who controls a wide expanse of land. How much does it say?
From India to Ethiopia.
From India, go ahead. From India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces. And he gives two banquets, but they're not church suppers, are they? First one lasts for how long? First one? 6 months. Right. First one lasts for 6 months, and the second one for 7 days. Okay, verse 10, on the seventh day, the last day of the second banquet, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha. I always feel like I'm reading Lord of the Rings here. Zethar and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served King Ahasuerus as chamberlains, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to behold. Okay, he wants to show off not only his riches, but also his wife. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command conveyed by the eunuchs. At this, the king was enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the seven princes of Persia and Media who saw the king's face, in other words, who had access to the king and sat first in the kingdom. And he said to them, According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti, because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus conveyed by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the princes, not only to the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also to all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt upon their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will be telling it to the king's princes, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go forth from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be altered, that Vashti is to come no more before King Ahasuerus, and to let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, vast as it is, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low. And so the message goes out. Okay, so Queen Vashti is sent from the court. And why?
Because she was a liberated woman.
Right. Because other women might hear that she said no, that she wouldn't come and show her beauty to the court. And then what would happen? Okay, so what happens? The king needs a new queen. And so the message goes out to all of these 127 provinces to find beautiful young virgins and have them brought to the palace for 1 year of beautifying treatment. Okay? Chapter 2, verse 9. No. Verse 12. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointment. After 1 year of beautifying treatment in the harem, then they are brought one by one before the king. They go at night to serve the king, as it were, and in the morning they go back to the harem. And there's sort of a second level of the harem. And after you've been with the king, you go to the second level and you're not called again unless the king has asked for you. One of these young, beautiful women who go to be in the harem of the king is a young Jew, and her name is Esther. And her turn comes to go before the king. And when she goes, he is so taken with her and her beauty that she is made the queen, and the crown is put upon her head. But the king doesn't know that she is a Jew. And she has been told by her uncle, whose name is Mordecai, not to tell the king, not to reveal to the court that she is a Jew. Okay, chapter 3. Enter the bad guy, whose name is Haman. And one of the important things to realize here is that Haman is an Agagite, and this is during the time of captivity. Mordecai, the Jew, is a Benjamite. Mordecai was brought into captivity, and there is an ancient a historical antagonism between the Benjamites and the Agagites. So there is an inherent antagonism between Mordecai and Haman. After these things, we missed a really important thing, verse 19 of chapter 2. Mordecai, the uncle, was very concerned about how Esther was getting along in this harem, and so he would wait, sitting at the king's gate. And when he was sitting there, he heard two eunuchs talking, plotting to kill the king. And he told Esther, and she told the king, and the two eunuchs were apprehended. And Mordecai's name was written in the book of Chronicles as one who had done valiant service for the nation. Okay, chapter 3. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and did obeisance to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or do obeisance. And the question is why? And perhaps this historical antagonism was part of that, that Mordecai would not bow down, or that Mordecai, being a Jew, would bow down only to God, although presumably he would also bow down to the king. And then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would avail, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or do obeisance to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And so what happens is that Haman goes to the king and says that, verse 8, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not for the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite and the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you." So Haman has the king's ring and makes the king sign on an edict to destroy the Jews. But the king doesn't know what Haman is doing, in that he doesn't know that they are the Jews. A little bit of foreshadowing of Iran Gate here, right? And so the decree goes out. Chapter 4. When Mordecai learned all that happened, what does he do? He rends his clothes, puts on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city, wailing with a loud and bitter cry. Okay, what is the sign of sackcloth and ashes? Mourning. And when a Jew dons sackcloth and ashes, not only do they mourn, but also they repent. It's also a sign of repentance, which we know from John the Baptist. Good. Also, they pray. Okay, so sackcloth and ashes. He goes to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting again. Always with fasting comes prayer. Fasting and weeping and lamenting, and most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. Okay, when Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. And what does she do? She doesn't put on sackcloth. She sends her eunuchs down to the gate to say to Mordecai, here are some garments, get dressed. Because of course she's in the court and nobody knows that she is a Jew. But Mordecai rejects the garments that she sends. And so she sends one of her eunuchs to go to Mordecai and ask him, what is happening here? And the message comes back to her, and Mordecai asks her to intercede with the king, to go to the king on behalf of her people and try to have this edict that has been signed with the king's ring to try to have it overthrown. And she's afraid. She doesn't want to go. And her reason is given in chapter 4, verse 11. She sends a message back to Mordecai and she says, all of the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike, even the queen, are to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter. Relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Okay, I want to read that again. Mordecai says to her, the woman who is a Jew within the court, within captivity, think not that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. And then what is Esther to? She sends her reply to Mordecai. Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. She is going to worship, a fast and prayer. Hold a fast on my behalf and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. The whole community is to fast. I and my maids will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. And so she goes. And the king holds out his royal scepter to her and says, oh, my queen, what is it that you want? Anything up to half of my kingdom. And she says, I would like to have a banquet for only 3 people, for the king and herself and Haman. And he says, of course. And so she prepares the banquet and Haman and the king come and they have the banquet. And he says, now, my queen, what would you like up to half my kingdom? And she says, I'd like you to come again tomorrow for a banquet. You and me and Haman. And Haman, who is a very ambitious person and very pleased about his rising up in the court of the king at this time, goes home and he gathers his wife and his friends and he tells them how well he is doing at court. And even the queen has called him to 2 private banquets. Meanwhile, the king that night went sleep. And so he has the wise man read to him from the book of Chronicles, and he comes across a reference to a man named Mordecai, who at one time had heard that there was a plot against the king and had saved the king. And so he's thinking, this man Mordecai has never been recognized for this. I must do something for Mordecai. And Haman, who had been talking with his family and friends about how well he was doing in the kingdom, was really irritated by this man Mordecai, who would not bow down to him. And his family and friends said, go, build a gallows 80 feet high to hang Mordecai. And he does, and he goes to the king to tell the king that he is going to hang this man who will not bow down to him. So early in the morning, Haman's there. And the king wants somebody to talk with and says, oh, Haman, come here, tell me. If there were a man in the kingdom that I really wanted to honor, what should I do? Haman thinks it's him. And so he says, what you do is you get a horse, and you put a crown on the horse's head, and you take your royal robes, and you put it on this man. And you put the man on the horse and you take him through the street and say, this is the man that he wants to honor. And the king says, payment. I want to honor Mordecai. Go, prepare, and take Mordecai to the street and says, the edict has been sent. The king's ring has been upon it, and the edict cannot be reversed. All that the king can do, if he does, is to tell the Jews that they can take their lives. And it becomes, in effect, a bloodbath with the Jews as the aggressors. And for 2 days, the Jews kill and destroy the people who hold them in exile. Question for us today is, as we look at the signs of the times, what does this story have to say to you? And is that question that Mordecai puts to Esther a question that we in any way need to hear? And where are we in the story? With whom do we identify? And what does that question mean for us? Perhaps you have come to this kingdom that we have described before. Perhaps, who knows, but perhaps you have come.